So welcome everyone
for our next installment of our JCC special classes that we're titling Coffee, Cake, and Learning. So this morning, Haman, Haman, and Hitler origin story. So the origins of Haman and Hitler are a little sketchy, but let's examine the text, and the texts are going to come courtesy of the Bible, of our Torah, and they're going to be kind of self-evident, where the genetics come from and perhaps how Haman and Hitler came to be who they became. Number one source. These are the names of Esau's sons. Esau was the twin brother, the red hair guy, bad guy, who was the brother of Jacob, of Yaakov. They were twins. And Esau had a bunch of kids. So it says these are their names. Eliphaz, who was the son of Adah, the wife of Esau. Then he had a son named Reuel, who was the son of Basmat, wife of Esau. So Esau liked his wives. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. And then it goes on to say, and this is the germane part to our story, and Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz, who was the son of Esau. And she bore to Eliphaz Amalek. And that name Amalek, that last word there, A-M-A-L-E-K, Amalek, is the nation, Amalek, that we identify Haman with, and most likely Hitler, and every would want to be Hitler that has ever existed in human history. So here's a little bit of the story before we go into source two. Esau himself was not a lover of Jacob and the Jewish people. Now remember, there really wasn't a Jewish people until Jacob famously wrestles, it was WrestleMania number one. He famously wrestles all night with this angelic figure who some identify as Esau's protector angel. And they wrestle the whole night. And then he gets hurt. His sciatic nerve, what they call the Gid Hanasha, gets damaged. And he's on like one healthy leg. But he is unrelenting, Jacob is. And he refuses to let Esau's angel go. He's holding him. The sparks of dawn are in the distance. And the angel says to Jacob, "Let me go. Dawn is coming, I have to go sing songs of praise before God. It's my day." Jacob says, "Okay, fine, I'll let you go. Conditionally, give me a bracha. I want a blessing from you, the angel of God, saying that I won and you lost. I want you to say it out loud." The angel's not a happy guy. He doesn't want to do this, but he has no choice. So he changes Jacob's name to Israel. So Jacob gets Yisrael, a second name that is given to Jacob, and we are all the children of Israel. That is the moment, if you will, of struggle where Jacob attains the mantle to be called Israel. In other words, up to that point in time in human history, it wasn't obvious that Jacob would be the one to be called Israel. He won it in battle. Okay, so a couple of takeaways. Number one, on a humorous side, because of the damage to the hip socket area, the sciatica, that sciatic nerve, so if you're a cow, that sciatic nerve happens to run in the best steak portions of a cow. So if you're into like filet mignon, New York cut steak, or anything in that sirloin area, that sciatic nerve, what that called the Gid Hanasha, sorry about this, but it runs right through that area. So in America, religious Jewish people in America, we just can't buy those areas. They don't bother even playing with them. When they slaughter, when they shecht a kosher animal, that part, the hind area, is given over to like the Outback Steakhouse people to enjoy. And Crocodile Dundee, of course. Right. So they get the enjoyment. We don't. But in Israel, where they get their meat from Argentina, because you know there's not a lot of agricultural land open for cows to farm in Israel. It's a very small country in comparison to America or Argentina, doesn't have the arable land that we have just to waste on cows, right? So they bring their meat in from Argentina. So Israel has shochets. They have experts who will actually, what's called treberine. They actually take the Gid Hanasha out, so you get a holy sirloin steak, meaning with holes, or a filet mignon. So if you go to Israel, you can get. I believe there's extras right over here for Mr. Yellen Esquire. Barry? Here, let me just pass one over to Barry. Here we go. Barry? So, that's one takeaway, that we get denied the sirloin area of the cow. But the other takeaway is that that moment created the nation of the Jewish people, meaning the 12 sons of Jacob are all born with the mantle of the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. That's how you have the Israelites and everything else from that moment. So it's concretized in history. It's a big moment. And the rabbis tell us Esau himself was very angry at Jacob. He didn't like the fact, although he begrudgingly admitted, I don't want to be the Jewish people, because Esau doesn't want to be the Jewish people. Because what does it mean to be the Jewish people? You get up and pray every day. You have to be honorable and holy. All things that are antithetical to an Esau. Esau likes to just enjoy the world, rape and pillage the world. And unfortunately, his children and grandchildren did a very good job of it over the years. So Esau still is resentful of his dear brother Jacob. And there is a rule that the rabbis cite. Ready for this? It says, Halacha hi biyadua, it is a known fact. She'esau soneh et Yaakov. Esau always has enmity, hatred, contempt for Jacob and the Jewish people. Now, you might say, well, isn't that enough to create and foment bad people historically? So the answer would be it is and it isn't. Because some of Esau's progeny, we believe, for example, that the Roman Empire descended from Esau. But again, for 26 years, the Roman Empire kept its treaties with the Jewish people living in what became later known as Palestine. You know that they called it Palestine, the Romans did, because they wanted to give it a shtoch, if you're good at Yiddish. They wanted to give the needle to the Jewish people. So they came up with some fake name from the Philistines, which inhabited part of Israel way, way back. So in order to sort of disconnect the Jewish people from the land of Israel, they, the Romans, came up with a fake name called Palestine. So when you hear people say Palestine, there never was a country called Palestine. It was a Roman invention in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba failed rebellion against the Roman rule, occupation of the Romans. They were so angry at the Jews that they renamed Israel Palestine. So it's a very interesting little historical sidelight. You may or may not know that, but you'll look it up on your own. You'll see that this is historically 100% accurate. Okay? So let's get back to the Romans. So the Romans were descended from Esau. So were the Romans always an enemy of the Jews? No. For a minimum of 26 years, they were okay. When we refused to acquiesce to their desires, you know, they started to make rules and regulations to outlaw Jewish rituals and learning and things. And it became really, really bad. But as bad as it became, and it culminated in the year 70 of the modern era, so it's like almost 2,000 years ago, with the destruction of the Temple number 2 in Jerusalem. The Romans did that. But nobody that I know of views the entirety of the Roman Empire as if they're like Nazis or something horrible. Yeah, they had good and bad, probably more bad than good, ultimately, especially for the Jews. But again, do they come from Esau? Yes. Did they have issues with Jews? 100%. Did they crucify and kill a bunch of Jews? Yes. Hundreds of thousands of Jews lost their lives. But that said, their level of, shall we say, evil does not rise to the level of Haman or Hitler or this nation called Amalek. Okay, but what's the foundation for where Haman and Hitler came from? I believe the foundation was laid in stone by the contempt that Esau had for Jacob. But that alone wasn't sufficient. No, 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 no. You needed this woman who's alluded to in source 1 at the end. It says there was a lady named Timnah who was a concubine to Eliphaz, son of Esau. She and Eliphaz together, they had a son named Amalek. So Amalek is quintessentially evil. But it took a combination, if you will, of Esau, who would have been Amalek's grandfather, that hatred on the patriarchal lineage side, together, amalgamating that hatred somehow with this Timna character. So source number two tells us a little bit about Timna. And I'm not going to go through all the source with you. You can read it yourself after, take it home. Let me give you the short notes, the cliff notes. You ready? Here's the cliff notes. Timna was born out of an adulterous relationship. Apparently, Eliphaz had a wife, but he played around with a guy named Seir's wife. And the two of them created, in their illegitimacy, this guy, this lady named Timna. Now, when Timna grew up, now it's going to get kind of gross. Eliphaz took Timna, even though it was technically his own daughter, through adultery, and he accepted her as a pilegish, as a concubine. So if you don't know what a concubine is, it's sort of like halfway between a wife and a prostitute, for lack of a better explanation. So when people had too many women who were like occupying their everyday, so a lot, very often rulers, monarchs, etc., would have a harem. And they would have all a bunch of these ladies who were like on their beck and call for intimate type purposes. When they wanted them, great. If not, I don't want to talk to you. So they didn't require the same sort of day-to-day care as a legitimate wife would. They were less than a wife. They didn't have all the obligations that a husband would have towards his wife. So therefore, it was a compromise. So Timna became a concubine, a pilegish, for this guy, Eliphaz. Who was Eliphaz again? The firstborn son of Esau. So did Eliphaz have bad stuff in him? Of course, look at his dad. But we are told that even though he had bad stuff in him, he had some good training. Because his Zadie, his grandfather, Eliphaz, you know who he was? You know him. He's your grandfather. Isaac. In other words, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the same genetics is true, Abraham, Isaac, Esau, right? The same family tree. So therefore, we are told by the rabbis that this character, Eliphaz, firstborn of Esau, when he was a little boy, he would sit on his Zadie, on his grandfather Isaac's lap, and Isaac would teach him Torah. Again, it wasn't a perfect relationship, but he had elements of light in him. That's what I'm trying to point out. So did he receive flawed genetics from Esau? Yes. Did he receive the genetics that said Esau hates Jacob, Israel, the Jews? Yes. But he also had Isaac's influence. So Eliphaz alone wasn't this horrific, nightmarish character. But apparently his concubine, Timna, was perverse and corrupt in a unique way. So here's the story. She wanted Timna to join Jacob's side of the family. But when she went to, I guess, Isaac and approached Isaac about, hey, is there a child of yours that I could get married with? Isaac probably sensed in Timna a fanaticism that was very unsettling. And therefore, Isaac and Jacob basically said, sorry, Timna, I know you want to join the Jewish people, but... And that's a laudable thing, but not as a wife. I'm sorry, it can't happen. So then she stood back and said, well, wait a minute. Abraham and Isaac's genetics don't just go through Jacob. As I mentioned a moment ago, the genetics of Abraham, Isaac also go through Esau. So I'll go to the Esau side of the family, which is kind of like the dark side, if you want a Star Wars analogy. So she went to the dark side. And she approaches Eliphaz, says, Eliphaz, and it's not clear whether she knew this was her biological father. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, maybe she did, she didn't. It makes it much worse if she did. And she basically said to Eliphaz, would you like a wife? And she's a pretty woman. She's throwing herself at him. And he said, you know, I have enough wives. I'm okay, thanks. Would you like my services as a concubine? Oh, yeah, sure, why not, right? So Timna joined the ranks of the family of Abraham and Isaac, but on the dark side, the Esau side, by becoming this concubine. And they had a single child together. And who was that child? Amalek. And who was Amalek? Amalek is the ancestor, as we're going to discover, of Haman and every really evil person who has contempt and enmity for the Jews. I can't prove, because I don't have a DNA test, that, you know, Hitler and Himmler, Yimach Shemam, means may their names be eradicated. I can't prove to you 100% that they genetically descend from Haman and from this union between Eliphaz and Timnah that created Amalek, but we're going to see that it's really irrelevant at some point. Okay? We'll discuss that at the end. So let's now skip to number 3 and 4. And again, I'm not going to go through the whole, it's more fun just for me to paraphrase the story in 3 and 4. So 3 and 4 is the biblical account of this product that we're calling Amalek, who is the child of this concubine Timnah, and her, and Amalek's dad was Eliphaz from Esau's son. Okay? Is everyone with us so far? So here's the biblical account. This first account comes to us from Exodus. You want to know when the account comes? It's actually in this week's Torah reading. That's how topical it is. This week, at the very end of Bishalach, in Exodus 17, is the original account of what happened with Amalek. Now, who was Amalek? Again, we know their lineage. They come from Esau. They come from this kind of fanatical woman named Timnah. Now think about it for a moment. When I say fanatical, what does it take for a woman to give herself up to be a concubine with no status because she's so desirous to somehow become part of this spiritual entity called Israel, the Jewish people? It takes a certain kind of twisted commitment. And maybe, that twisted commitment of Timnah, in other words, her fanaticism, together with the genetics of Esau, which already we know are capable of creating a Roman Empire that could do some bad stuff, but maybe Timnah and her genetics corrupt the Esau already predisposed to not like the Jews' genetics and create a hybrid called Amalek. And Amalek's pretty bad. So here's the story. The Jewish people in our parsha this week coming up, in Exodus 17, they come from the Red Sea. And the Red Sea splitting was a marvelous event. For everybody, for everyone other than Yul Brynner and the Egyptians, it was a momentous occasion, right? It was a great moment. Splitting of the Red Sea. By the way, I saw this when I was a little boy. We did a tour of Universal Studios. So I saw Charlton Heston split that Red Sea.
Oh my God.
All right, fine. But it was not as magnificent live as it was, I'm sure, in the Cecil B. DeMille movie, right? We all remember the great movie. But it was still a momentous occasion. The Jewish people come, split the sea, God saves us, everything's great. But then as soon as we get into the desert, we start to complain. And that's the class that I'm giving Monday night, complaining about miracles. At the end of the complaints, the Jewish people find themselves in a place called Rephidim. And in Rephidim, the Jewish people are so, whatever they are, they have become something non-believers, which is kind of staggering. Because just a few moments ago, they were seeing the hand of God split the sea and think, oh my gosh, you know, God's with us. You know what they say out loud? Is God amongst us or not? Hayesh Hashem b'kaveinu im'ayim. Where is God? Is he in us? Now, they didn't say, does God exist? I mean, that they knew. But is God with us? Is he inside us? Meaning, would he be in my soul, my heart? And of course, it's a rhetorical question. Because God could only be present in your life and my life if we make room for God. If we exclude God, then of course the answer is no. Because if he's not in your heart and in your soul, if you don't believe and you don't make room for a God, then where would he be? Where would Hashem be other than in you? So the Jewish people had the temerity, the audacity. We have a good word for audacity in Hebrew, ready? Chutzpah. They had the chutzpah to say, is God in our midst or not? So what happens? One verse later, Amalek shows up for the very first time on the scene. And this Amalek is a small, kind of Bedouin-style family, and they attack us. But the attack was insane, because the Jewish people at this point had God directly. Did anyone see Star Wars? Remember there was like the Death Star had a shield? So we had God's shield. The clouds of glory protected us. You couldn't hurt the Jewish people. Good luck. You know, if you cast stones, rocks, missiles, projectiles, they would simply be absorbed by God's magical clouds. Pretty cool stuff. By the way, Israel, thank God, has created the same type of thing today. You know, if you look carefully, I mean, I'm drawing an analogy. It's a great analogy. Israel has created this amazing system which begins low level with a special missile structure that shoots down incoming missiles. There's a second level, and then there's even a, called the Arrow system, which will shoot down, God forbid, intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're the only one in the world. So they've created their own shield to create a protection against the Amaleks of our modern world, which is kind of a neat idea. So Amalek then makes a suicide attack. It's the only word I can use. It's a suicide attack. And they attack the few people that are at the tail end and exposed, not under coverage of the cloud of glory that protects them. And then what happens? Moses and Joshua get the army ready. Now again, the Jewish people are not really trained as fighters. They don't have like the Israel Defense Force yet, right? They don't have any F-35 fighter jets to strike against the Amalek. So Joshua takes the army and he goes out into battle and he defeats Amalek that day. Now we're going to learn that it wasn't all of Amalek that he defeated. He just, whoever was there, he wasn't allowed to destroy all of Amalek, just the ones who had perpetrated this unprovoked attack. It was a suicide, unprovoked attack against the Jews. Joshua leads the men. Moses is there in prayer. He's up on a mountain with his brother Aaron, his nephew Hur, and he's praying on behalf of the Jewish people. He's the inspiration behind the battle. Joshua, who will lead the Jewish people into the Promised Land when they will take over Israel from the Canaanites, he leads the men and they wipe out Amalek on that day. And listen to the words at the end of source number 3. This is now beginning with the fifth line from the end. The Lord, I left out the O because I don't want to write the whole name of God. The Lord said to Moses, inscribe this as a memorial in the book and recite it to Joshua's ears, that I will surely obliterate the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens. And then Moses built an altar and he named it, the Lord is my miracle. And he said, for there is a hand on the throne of the Eternal, that there should be a war for the Lord against Amalek from generation to generation. So this is the word of God. He's saying that you Jewish people, there's a specific mandate that you are going to be challenged generationally by this entity known as Amalek. And as long as you have a government and a judiciary and a king, you should wage this eternal battle. Whether it's a physical battle like it was here, or could it be in some cases more of a spiritual battle against this wicked entity called Amalek that attacked us on this day. Now, in source number 4, and I'll read it to you, okay? In fact, I'll just say it out. I'll say it out loud. All right. The Jewish people had questioned, as we said, the existence of whether God was in their midst. Let me ask you, how after the 10 plagues of Egypt and all the miracles, that this is the same Jewish people, right? How could they question whether God was with them? So God says, oh, you question me? So here's the analogy. It's a story, not a real story. There was a father who had a beautiful little prized son. He loved his son. He loved him so much he would carry him on his shoulders. And everywhere they went, the little boy would see something that he wanted. He'd say, Abba, Abba, Daddy, could you buy that new Apple iPad for me? And Dad would say, sure, of course. So he'd buy him the new iPad. Daddy, Daddy, candies, bubblegum. And Dad did it all. He provided protection, nourishment, everything. And then one day, Dad is carrying the little boy on his shoulders and walking down a road. And there's a stranger walking the other way. And the little boy addresses the stranger. He says, sir, excuse me, have you seen my father? Do you know where he is? And then the stranger walks by. So the father is very unimpressed, to say the least. So he picks up his little son off his shoulders, and he says, what? I've carried you on my shoulders all this time. I've provided for you, protected for you. And you have the chutzpah, the audacity to ask, where's Dad? And he takes the boy and he kind of casts him down on the side of the road. At that moment, a pit bull, I have to pick the deadliest dog, the pit bull named, let's call him for fun, Adolf. Adolf the pit bull comes out of nowhere and he's about to attack the little boy. Abba, Abba, oh, Dad, please save me from Adolf the Pit Bull. And of course, Dad saves him. So you see the analogy. In other words, the Jewish people cry out, is God in our midst or not? God is like, what? I carried you on the wings of eagles out of Egypt. Split the sea, did miracle after miracle for you. I protected, provided for you. And you ask, where is God? Am I with you? And so he casts the Jewish people down, metaphorically. Along comes Adolf, Haman, Amalek. And as soon as Amalek comes, what do the Jews do? Oh, please, Hashem, God, I remember you. Please save us. So what is the response? When we lose sight of God and our faith and trust in God, sometimes, tragically, we need a reminder. Sometimes it's painful to redirect our thoughts and focus towards where God really is, where he's always been. So everyone understands that. The context of this original attack. So the takeaway is very simple. When we as Jews, as a nation of Israel, or anyone, question whether God is with me personally, whether he's taking care of me, in good and bad, then sometimes the bad comes to redirect ourselves to the reality of God. Have you ever noticed that every single hospital you'll ever visit, they have one thing in common, they always have a chapel to pray in. It's like the old atheist in a foxhole, right? Because when your life is on the line, all of a sudden, give me that old-time religion. And it crosses every spectrum of religiosity, without question, okay? And the other thing we discovered was even though Amalek showed his head that day to attack the Jews as they were coming out of Egypt in the Exodus process, but it's a multi-generational, eternal battle that God and God's people are going to wage against this entity known as Amalek. And that Joshua subdued them that day. Yeah, they won the battle. But the eternal war was not won that day. Okay, turn over the page, please. So then we have three verses at the end of our Torah, at the end of the Bible, in Deuteronomy 25. And it kind of gives us not information about the attack that I just shared with you all, but more editorial. How and why did the Amalek people show up that fated day in the wilderness to attack us? So here are the words. I'll read it to you, number 5. This is actually a biblical requirement. On the Sabbath, Shabbat, before Purim, we come to temple, to synagogue, and we read these three verses out loud. It's called Shabbat Zachor, the Sabbath of Remembrance. Remembering the Amalek attack, the original attack. Now clearly, if it's before Purim, what is it also remembering? The ancestry of Haman. And the story, the background of Purim, because it's right before Purim. So here is the original account. But again, you'll notice this is like the New York Times editorial page. This is not the news on the front page. This is editorial of God. But because God is editorializing, it's truth. You shall remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you went out of Egypt. How he happened upon you on the way and cut off all the stragglers at your rear. When you were faint and weary, and he, Amalek, did not fear God. Therefore, it will be when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall obliterate the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens. You shall not forget. So here's the question that we're going to try to answer right now. If Amalek was going to fail, I mentioned to you, we had God's divine protection on that day that they attacked us in the wilderness. The clouds of glory were right over us. And try as hard as he may, Amalek doesn't have, on that day, the potentiality, the capability of destroying the Jewish people. They can't really even inflict a serious casualty count. So what was the purpose then? The purpose is what a suicide bomber tries to do. And I believe that the suicide bombers of modern day are metaphorical descendants of Amalek. And then we'll see inside. What does a suicide bomber try to do? You can't take Israel down by blowing up 25 men and women and children in a Zabaros pizza shop like what happened 20 years ago. By killing, murdering in cold blood, 7 Sabbath worshippers, which happened this last Friday in Jerusalem by gunning them down as they're leaving the synagogue after prayer services on a Sabbath. You can't destroy the Israeli army and the nation. But what can you say to them? You're not safe. Wherever you pray, wherever you live, I can touch you. I can find you. So it's a very powerful, unsettling statement. Right? You think about it. All the murdering suicide bombers of history, even when they took our Twin Towers down, they're not taking America down, but they came pretty close, didn't they? We lost 3,000, but we had 330 million. So how did that work? Because bin Laden, Yimach Shemo, and his evil minions, it was a statement. I can strike at the heart of America, the example, the World Trade Center in the downtown Manhattan, most glorious city that you ever created. I can hit you where I can use your airplanes as missiles against you, and I can destroy from within your own belief system and who you are and what you are. So that is the Amalekite style. In other words, they're not trying to militarily take us one-on-one. We can't use our advanced technology in a battlefield because they won't fight us in a conventional warfare situation. So we can't, all the weapons, right? You can't send out your Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier, you know, loaded up with F-35 lightning strikers and Hornets. You can't attack a Amalek that way, really, because they won't show themselves. They'll be hiding in a cave somewhere in, I don't know, maybe Afghanistan, right? Or somewhere in Pakistan. They'll be hiding. They're not going to show themselves. They're going to hit where it really hurts. They'll blow up like 50 people that happened at a mosque in Pakistan this past week, right, where the Taliban blew up 50 worshippers. Again, it's a statement. And here is the Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the great biblical commentator. He explains, it's amazing, right, because he wrote this 1,000 years ago. But it defines our world right now. Listen to this. The Hebrew word karcha. So it says in our parsha, he happened upon you. Well, did he just happen to meet you, Amalek, or was it by design? Clearly it was by his design that he attacked you at that moment. Why did he choose that moment? It's an expression denoting a chance occurrence. Mikra. Meaning, I happened to get you. We'll explain that in a moment. Another explanation is an expression denoting heat and cold. He cooled you off and made you appear tepid after you were boiling hot. For the nations of the world were afraid to fight you, just as people are afraid to touch something boiling hot. But this Amalek came forward and started and showed the way to others. This can be compared to a bathtub of boiling water into which no living creature could descend. Along came a crazy guy, some irresponsible schlub, and he jumped headlong into the boiling water. Although he scalded himself, he succeeded in making others think that the water was cooler than it really was. Two things just happened. Amazing. Let me spread them out for you, okay? Number one, happenstance. If he happened upon you, that he's trying, Amalek is trying to show the Jewish people specifically, but we've extrapolated from there to include moral human beings everywhere in our world. He's trying to show you that just stuff happens. In other words, God may exist, but God's like an absentee landlord. He's up in heaven. No? He doesn't need to involve himself in the intimate details of your life and my life. So stuff happens, right? Things happen. And it happened that Amalek chanced upon you on the road. So he's trying to show the Jewish people that God doesn't really care for you. He doesn't really take care of you. He's not really there all the time protecting you. And stuff happens. You can't predict what happens. In fact, you could throw a lottery and come up with a day and a month to kill the Jews, and it just will land on whatever it lands on, and that'll be the day the Jews die. Oh my gosh, that sounds like what Haman did when he threw the lottery. Well, that's why we call the holiday Purim, which means lots, because he threw lots to decide what day and what month. He's keeping exactly to that recipe. In other words, if you can convince the other person through your actions that God might exist, yes or no, but God is not interested or part of our lives day by day. And things bad can happen. They can just happen. Stuff happens. And then the second one is really the raison d'etre. It's the purpose of a suicide bomber. Because as we said, what's the purpose of a suicide bomber? You don't bring down a government by a suicide bomb. You don't destroy an army or a navy or an air force. But you destroy the will and you create self-doubt into the ones that you kill. And that self-doubt can bring down an empire. And that's what a Malik, that's the MO, the modus operandi of a Malik, is to create that doubt. Is God really with me? How could that have happened if God is a benevolent, loving God? How could stuff like this happen? So that doubt, and by the way, the Hebrew word for doubt is safek, doubt. And in Jewish numerology, a Malik's letters in Hebrew, you have to trust me on this one, are the same numerology as the word doubt. So that's his baseline will, to create a doubt. Is God really with us or not? If God was, then how come this stuff could have happened? So let's look at the analogy that Rashi gave. Ready? There's this overheated pool, and everyone is like, well, we're not going near the pool. That was the status of the Jewish people after we destroyed the one superpower in the world, Yul Brynner and the Egyptians. They were the cultural centerpiece of the world. So when the nations of, let's say, Canaan, or Esau's descendants, called the Edomites, when they heard about the destruction and downfall of Pharaoh and Egypt, they're not going to touch us. They're like the Andre the Giant kid who's 7'4 on the playground. No little kid in the school is going to mess with them during recess. Yeah, but what if a little pitzela, a little boy, let's call him Bad Billy, he's all of 4'1", both up and sideways, pudgy little boy. And at recess, he comes over to the little boy. He's a quiet little boy. We'll call him Andre the Giant. He's a quiet little boy, happens to be 7'4". He's taken, you know, fifth grade a few times. And he's out there on the playground. And little Billy comes over and starts kicking dirt and sand against Andre. No other kid in this school would ever even think. They couldn't even conceive of any crazy person kicking sand and initiating a fight with Andre the Giant. And so Andre gets ticked off, and he picks little Billy up, and he just casually throws him across the schoolyard. So they take Billy away, the paramedics take him away. But you know what happened? Every other child in that school will no longer look at Andre from that day on with that same sense of fear and trepidation. Because Billy did something unthinkable. He attacked the Twin Towers. He attacked the pizza shop or the synagogue and made everybody feel, oh, you know what? He's not so invulnerable. If little Billy could attack, what possibilities do we have? So in other words, by jumping into that pool and committing suicide, he cooled off, metaphorically speaking, all the world and the way they looked at the Jews. They're not untouchable. Yeah, they had a cloud that day when Amalek attacked us. He couldn't win the war. But was a statement. What was the statement? You Jews, you're so righteous. You're so great. You're not always going to have God's divine protection. And if I can't destroy you today in the wilderness because the clouds happen to be protecting you and all my missiles get absorbed and just dissolved by God's plan, maybe one of my grandchildren, the guy with the triangle hat, maybe he will succeed one day in destroying the Jews. And if Haman doesn't just succeed in destroying the Jews, maybe my great-great-grandson, Schicklgruber, with the little mustache, maybe he'll have more success in destroying the Jews. So in other words, it's a multi-generational sequence of events that you have, and I'll take it from its origins. This is the origin story. You have this fanatic named Timnah, who is so desirous of some twisted religion that she makes herself a prostitute, a concubine, to cohabit with Eliphaz. And they create this entity called Amalek, and Amalek draws on the wellspring of the enmity of Esau, the hatred that Esau has, but it's not enough. But Timnah's twisted psyche creates this one child, Amalek, whose whole purpose is to undermine and destroy the Jews. So in other words, if you said to the Amalekite, are you willing to strap on explosives and walk into a kosher pizza store and kill 20 children? Do you not realize that you blow up? The nails will rip your body to shreds? And he'll smile at you and say, what happens to the little Jewish children? I'm okay with that. Now, is that a sane position? Of course not. But this is the reality of what has created our world today, what Israel faces every day, what America faces, what I would say all of Society faces this issue right here. So in other words, the Amalek of the world, and I'll prove this to you, right? Twice. It happened not once, but twice. Haman, in the story of the book of Esther, is at the height of his powers. He's the richest guy in the land. Queen Esther has led him to believe that she has kind of like a little bit of a flirtatious crush on him. And he's one step away from deposing King Ahasuerus, and then Haman will become the king. So things are going great. The letter to destroy the Jews has been sent out by the king's own signet ring signature. Everything's going great. He leaves the palace, and there's one Jew sitting outside the palace named Mordecai. And Mordecai doesn't even acknowledge the existence of Haman. He won't stand for him. He won't salute him. He won't bow. Nothing. And Haman goes home to his family, and he's in such a rage. He says to his wife and his loved ones, I can't live in a world that Mordecai's allowed to live. But Haman, he's going to die along with the rest of the Jews in a couple months. I can't wait for that moment. I must preempt that moment. I want Mordecai's head on a platter now, the horse's head. I want him dead, dead, and deader. What say you guys? And everyone says, well, okay, fine. If you don't want to wait, how about we build a big gallows and make a big public execution of Haman? So what did Haman do at that moment? He undermined himself because he ends up swinging on the gallows, right? He can't wait because he's Haman. He's a Amalek. He won't wait for the destruction of all Jewry. I need to act now. I won't wait for a few months from now. And unwittingly, he undermines his own position. And from that moment on, literally in the story, it's the fall of Haman. So he's at the pinnacle of his power. And at the moment that he can't wait because he's so desirous of the murder of Mordecai, boom, the story ends with him swinging on the gallows. Let's fast forward. My son-in-law finished a book by Bill O'Reilly called Killing the SS. Some of you may have seen the book. You know, Bill O'Reilly has the killing series, you know, Killing Kennedy, Killing Lincoln. So we did it like an audio on tape. It's very powerful stuff. As a Jew, it's heartbreaking. But there is something there that's amazing. And this is Hitler doing exactly what Haman did. In 1943, he creates the marching orders with Adolf Eichmann and Machshima. Most of the book is about how they got Eichmann and brought him to Israel, put him on trial, and eventually capital punishment. But the final solution, which was believed to be ordained at something called the Wannsee Conference, was a mysterious little conference that the Nazis had, and they sort of came up with the final solution. So they enshrined in their mission statement, if you will, Auschwitz-Birkenau and the death camps that killed our people. Okay. But at that point in time in 1942-43, Hitler could easily have sued for peace with Winston Churchill, the British, and the people themselves. Now what happened? His own generals were like, Hitler, I don't understand. We can't go forward now. Why are you taking our soldiers, our manpower, that could be used to win a war? We're fighting Russia, we're fighting the US now. We can't win, and you're taking valuable manpower and energy and resources. To what end? The final solution? Wait! Fight the war, sue for peace, enshrine the 1,000-year Reich, then you'll deal with the Jews afterwards. Are you insane? What was Hitler's response to his people? He ignored his own generals. You know, eventually, Rommel and the rest, Schellenberg, they tried to kill him because they said, this is ridiculous. You're losing. Why are you trying to kill the 6 million or more Jews now? Wait till Purim coming up, and then you'll, why build the gallows now? Would Hitler wait? No. Now again, I understand that it came at a cost which is unimaginable to the Jews. What would the cost have been had he waited those couple years and used the manpower of his army to cement the war victory in Europe? What do you think would, you know, I'll tell you two takeaways. Everyone around this table, you'd either be dead or a lampshade right now. Because I promise you that had he won the war, no Jew anywhere in the world would have been safe. No Jew. No Jew. Because we know he was on the precipice of both the technology to deliver nuclear weapons with the rockets that he created, that his people created, right? It was only by the grace of God that one of his nuclear physicists corrupted his nuclear program, deliberately feeding him misinformation about the technology and gave that technology to America and not to Hitler. But I promise you, had things played out differently, He could have won, just like maybe Haman could have won. But he can't win, because I proved to you through the origin story of Haman and Hitler that they can't wait for that moment. And they will suicide themselves out of our world. They'll gladly get on an airplane and not even know how to land the airplane. Do you remember that the 19, they took flying lessons in Florida? Somehow we missed it, our government. Do you know what they didn't take lessons on? How to land the airplanes.
Wow.
So as, I think his name is Meyer. What's this guy's name? Bill Maher. So he got in a lot of trouble because he said this. But there's truth to what he said. He said, you can say what you want about those 19 guys, but you can't call them cowards. Do you remember that? He said that right after 9/11, and people were really angry. Meaning he was essentially saying that those 19 guys got on those airplanes with no exit strategy. Their exit strategy was basically to say Allahu Akbar and to hit the Pentagon, the Trade Center, and I guess the White House was where the one in Pennsylvania was going to go. So again, that is a mullet. Getting on an airplane with no ability to land the aircraft and murdering the flight crew instantly is a mullet. This is their MO, correct? So let's end with the following. I can't give you a happy takeaway. I'm sorry. We said that God has a war against Amalek, Midor-dor, from generation to generation. And that means that whether the dog in our analogy who's going to bite the little boy who forgot about his dad, whether that dog is literally an Amalek or whether he's acting like Amalek, and I don't really care. If it barks like a dog and if it bites like a dog, it's a dog. So you may say to me, but Rabbi, the suicide bombers of today, they may descend from Ishmael. And I'll say to you, good, new. How does that make a difference? In other words, if a person has picked up the mantle of the Amalek, Haman, Hitler view, the mindset of their willingness, like Timnah, to give up her own self to become a prostitute, at such cost to herself, if there's such a willingness like Timnah had to jump in at whatever the cost was to her, she needed it. She wanted to be part of it. That fanaticism, and it could be any religion, it could be any demographic, it could be any ethnicity, unfortunately. So what's the takeaway? That we as the Jewish people, we as people who are lovers of our world, we have to constantly be on the lookout. We have to be vigilant to keep teaching the world the history of where it comes from, the context, just like God teaches us in the Torah, the context of where this all came from. And if we have a better understanding, then we can undermine the nature of what they attempt to do. Let me leave you with something good. When Haman loses, he takes the Jewish people in their victory, and they take the happenstance coincidence, remember? Because that's Haman's desire, to say stuff just happens to you. Sometimes you win, sometimes the dice rolls and you get bad cards. It happens, okay, no. But at the end of the day, when Esther, Mordecai, and the Jews triumph in the story of Purim, it says that they, for the Jewish people, Haitolahem, Ora Visimcha, they had light and joy for the Jewish people. And something precious, Yakar. But the word yakar, precious, is the same letters as the word happenstance. But it's changed from the word happenstance, that stuff happens, to things are precious. Precious means it's not cold. It's not without meaning. That whatever happens in our world, we have to believe that God has a divine plan and that God loves each and every one of us for all the travails, health issues, whatever we have. If we will keep that belief system, we'll never allow a Amalek, whatever Amalek perpetrates, we will stand with who we are and what we are and never allow that to undermine our faith, our belief, number one in ourselves, and number two in who we are and what we are. So that should be my blessing to everyone today.